Throughout the 50 days of Easter, sacred music for the world. LutheranPublicRadio.org. Listen 24/7 to sacred music for the Easter season. LPR, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Joining us to talk about New Testament narratives and distorted memories, Dr. Bart Ehrman, Distinguished Professor of Religious Studies at the University of North Carolina, author of several books, including his latest, Jesus Before the Gospels. Dr. Ehrman, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thanks for having me.
Near the end of your book, you have this to say, kind of by way of conclusion. You say, the historical Jesus did not make history. The remembered Jesus did. For me, as an historian, it goes without saying that we should pay close attention to what can be learned about the historical Jesus, but we should not neglect the remembered Jesus. What are you saying there, Dr. Ehrman?
So when a historian talks about the historical Jesus, they mean the Jesus as can be reconstructed as what he really said and did. And different scholars, of course, have different reconstructions of how to understand the historical Jesus. What I'm arguing in the book is that these historical reconstructions are not what affect people when they think about Jesus. There are 2 billion people in the world today who understand themselves to be Christian, and the vast majority of them don't have a view of Jesus that would correspond to what critical scholars would say Jesus was really like. And so what Jesus was really like isn't affecting people nearly as much as the Jesus that they have in their memories.
So you talk in the book about distorted memories when it comes to the New Testament narratives about the life of Jesus and about his death as well. Can you give us some examples of those distorted memories?
I devote a couple of chapters in the book to talking about distorted memories. One chapter deals with distorted memories about the death of Jesus, and another deals with distorted memories about the life of Jesus. And what I do is I show that there are accounts in the Gospels that have are at odds. You'll have a description of the same event that would have a discrepancy in it, and if there's a difference between two accounts, then they can't obviously be historically right, and one of them represents a distorted memory. I mean, just as one example, in the Gospel of Mark, Jesus is said to die the morning after he has eaten the Passover meal with his disciples. In the Gospel of John, we're told that Jesus died the day before the Passover meal was eaten. So they both can't be right, since Jesus didn't die two different times. And so the question is, you know, is one of them right, and is one of them a distorted memory?
I guess I'm wondering about the kind of the disagreement or the discrepancies between these accounts. Would you require 100% agreement for you to look at an account like this and say, these two authors are relaying accurately the same event?
No, what I say in the book is that experts on memory, people who are, for example, cognitive psychologists who study memory, would say that there's a difference between a gist memory and a detailed memory. And often the gist of a memory can be right and accurate, but a detail could be wrong. Sometimes gist memories themselves are wrong. But in this particular case, I would say the gist memory is right, that Jesus certainly did die, he certainly was crucified, and it was sometime around the Passover. And so both Mark and John are right about that. Where they differ is in the detail, and one of them simply has a wrong memory about the detail.
So I mean, back to my percentage question again, what percentage of agreement between accounts is required in your mind before you are willing to kind of sign off on that and say what we're dealing with here are simply two different details being not recalled differently, but in fact just one guy includes a detail, the other one leaves it out?
Yeah, well, in this case, they both include a detail, and at that point of the detail, one of them is 100% wrong because they can't both be 100% right. But you can't take a memory and say what percentage of this memory, you know, it's not like you can say, you know, 43% of this memory is right. Scholars of memory, cognitive psychologists simply don't do it that way.
But we do in a narrative text have kind of point for points. We can, in a sense, kind of diagram the sentences, so to speak, for their content and say agreement, disagreement, tick them off into those categories, can't we?
Well, scholars don't.
But, I mean, we can in the case of, say, an example of disagreement. They both agree that he died. They disagree on the day. Put the day in the disagreement category and the died in the agreement category.
Well, if you insist on doing that, then you'd have a 50-50 agreement.
All right. Is that sufficient to say which one is right?
No. That isn't really what my book is about. It's not about calculating a percentage agreement or disagreement. It's about trying to understand how memory works. How do our memories work? How do we misremember things? How do we forget things? How, in fact, sometimes do we invent memories? And the question in my book is, how does our understanding of memory, based on what psychologists and sociologists and anthropologists have said, how does this understanding of memory that has been scientifically established help us understand better how the early Christians were remembering Jesus?
What were they remembering? I mean, the earliest Christians, as far as you can tell, what were they seeing and hearing that they were remembering in the first instance? I'm talking about someone who actually saw it and actually heard these things. What do you think they were actually seeing and hearing?
You mean eyewitnesses to the life of Jesus?
Yes.
I think they were remembering the things Jesus said and did.
Can you give me an example?
Well, I think they remembered his apocalyptic teachings that the end was soon going to come, for example. They remembered that he was a Jewish preacher from rural Galilee. They remembered that he came from Nazareth. They remembered that he had brothers. They remembered that he had a mother and father. They remembered that he taught that one needed to prepare because God was soon to intervene in judgment to overthrow the forces of evil and bring in a good kingdom. So they remembered a lot of things. I mean, so it's a little hard to say it in 30 seconds because, you know, like many other people, I've written an entire book on what it is they were remembering.
Did they also remember his predictions of his death and resurrection?
Oh, they certainly did. They're in the Gospels.
The eyewitnesses of the actual Jesus.
Oh, we don't know that because we don't have any of the writings of the eyewitnesses.
So what about the apocalyptic writings? You are making reference to something there, aren't you? You were referring before to things that are actually in the Gospels.
You were asking me what people remembered, and I was telling you what they remembered. The thing about memory is that memories are not always accurate. So the fact you remember something doesn't mean that something actually happened.
Can we compare how memories, since your book does deal a lot with memory, can we compare how memories are formed and how they function in a modern literate culture like ours with how memories are formed in oral and mostly non-literate communities?
Yeah, that's one of the real challenges. And so the way to talk about memory in oral cultures is to study what we know about oral cultures. And I have an entire chapter on that where I talk about what anthropologists have learned about oral cultures. And it turns out that what they have learned about oral cultures is not what you often hear. People who are just kind of guessing what oral cultures would be like. For example, I always had learned that in oral cultures, people tended to preserve their memories more accurately without changing them because they didn't have anything to check. They didn't have any written accounts to check, and so they simply made sure that they didn't ever change any of their stories or their traditions. So scholars have studied oral cultures, and it turns out that that's not right at all, that in oral cultures, the very idea that you should not change something doesn't exist. In oral cultures, it's simply assumed that when you tell a story or retell a tradition, you do change it. You change it precisely because of the context within which you're telling it.
So you're familiar with Robert Funk and the Jesus Seminar. How does your method and how do your results compare with that seminar's attempt to kind of get at what Jesus really said and did?
Well, sort of in broad outline, it's similar. I wasn't a member of the Jesus Seminar, and I didn't really agree with the results that they came up with. And I disagreed with most of their criteria, frankly. But the idea, the basic idea that they have, that there are sayings in the New Testament Gospels that do not reflect the things that Jesus actually said, I think are absolutely right. And I think what I do in my book is I show how that's the case. Let me just give you an example. In Matthew chapters 5, 6, and 7, we have the Sermon on the Mount, which is, by all accounts, one of the greatest, probably the greatest set of ethical teachings in the history of our planet. Matthew was writing sometime maybe in the 80s of the Common Era, so maybe 50 years after Jesus' death. And so the question is, how would somebody 50 years later know exactly what Jesus said on this one occasion? I ask my students sometimes, for example, if they're able to reproduce for me what they heard in Obama's last State of the Union address. Well, of course they can't reproduce it, but it was just a few months ago. What about a speech that Obama gave 7 years ago? Can they reproduce that exactly? No, of course they can't. So what are the chances that somebody like Matthew, 50 years later, could record word for word exactly what Jesus said? Well, I would agree with the Jesus seminar that the chances are fairly remote.
Also, regarding another kind of scholar of this from a previous century, Rudolf Bultmann, he was, and his contemporaries, were seeking what he called a message of faith apart from actual historical events in the New Testament narratives. Do you agree that there is a message of faith there in the New Testament Gospels? And if so, what is it?
I wouldn't say that there's a message of faith. I'd say that the Gospels are certainly trying to propound faith, and that I would agree with Bultmann that the Gospels are often historically inaccurate, but that there is a message that's being delivered. I wouldn't agree with Bultmann what the message was. Bultmann was an existentialist who thought that there was a kind of almost a non-religious existential message in the Gospels. I think the Gospels are trying to proclaim that a person has to have faith in Christ in order to have salvation.
You gave the analogy about the memories of President Obama's various State of the Union addresses or speeches. Is this a fair comparison? President Obama is a remarkable character, no doubt, but is this a fair comparison with a man who made the lame walk, the blind see, and raised
the
dead?
No, I certainly don't think Obama is the Messiah.
I didn't want to apply that.
I'm not comparing Obama to Jesus. I'm comparing our memories. Even if you listen to somebody who is quite remarkable, maybe take the most remarkable person you know, if you hear something they say, and you tell that to somebody who tells it 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 to somebody until 50 years later, somebody else writes it down, what are the chances of that most remarkable person's words being remembered precisely correct? And I'm saying that the chances are infinitesimally remote.
That's words, and there I think I could grant your contention in principle, but we're also talking about deeds and actions that were not necessarily attached to specific words, like dying and rising from the dead, things like rising from the dead. When did that idea actually enter the chain of the kind of the telephone game you were describing there?
Well, I think right after Jesus' death, his followers were saying that he got raised from the dead.
Were they telling the truth, or what were they doing there? What were they remembering or misremembering?
I think some of them had visions of Jesus after his death, and they thought that he had been raised from the dead.
Okay, so they are remembering visions. When does it become not a vision, but Jesus eating fish, they touch and handle him, things like that?
You know, that's not really something I deal with in the book.
So you're not really willing to say when along the chain of the telephone game there it went from being a vision to a bodily.
You're asking me about 12 questions at once. So if you're asking me when did the disciples begin to say that Jesus ate a piece of fish? So that's recorded in the Gospel of Luke. Luke was written probably in the mid-80s. We don't have a record of that incident in Matthew or in Mark, which were both written earlier. And so the earliest we can date this recollection is in the mid-80s. If you think that it happened earlier, you know, possibly it did. Paul talks about the resurrected Jesus. He doesn't say anything about it. The earlier Gospels don't say anything about it. So if you're simply trying to date something on the basis of the surviving evidence, you don't have any evidence for existing before the mid-80s. I do talk about this in another book. I mean, I thought we were going to talk about the book I just wrote, but I do have another book called How Jesus Became God, where I go into all of these kinds of details.
1 Corinthians is usually dated earlier than the Gospels by many scholars. 1 Corinthians account there.
I think everybody dates it earlier.
There we have St. Paul not only kind of repeating the kerygma of the, you know, that scholars have noticed in this kind of common outline of preaching of the historical facts of Jesus' life, death, and resurrection. But Paul there actually makes the bodily resurrection central to the Christian faith. How do you explain that?
Because Paul thought the bodily resurrection was central to the Christian faith.
Apart from it actually being any kind of history or any eyewitnesses, he does claim 500 eyewitnesses at one time.
That's right. That's what he thought.
But did any of that actually occur?
Are you asking me what Paul thought, or are you asking me what happened historically?
What happened historically?
What Paul says is that a number of people saw Jesus alive afterwards, and I think that that's true. A number of people did see Jesus alive afterwards.
Did the apostles subscribe to a worldview, for lack of a better term, Dr. Ehrman, in which there's kind of this transcendent truth, they would say even saving truth, apart from history?
The transcendent truth apart from, I don't think people in the first century had the idea either of transcendent truth or of what we would call history.
What were their concepts then if they didn't have those?
Well, the idea of transcendent truth and history have come down to us from the Enlightenment. So prior to the Enlightenment, people simply didn't talk in those categories. I mean, I think, for example, if you get out a concordance of the New Testament, you'll never find the term transcendent. If you read what ancient people talk about when they talk about events that happened in the past, they don't talk about things like objective history. These are modern categories that ancient people simply didn't have.
So Paul was not operating with that category when he made the claims in First Corinthians.
Of course
15.
Not. He was a first century man. He wasn't a 21st century man.
So
he didn't live after the Enlightenment, so he can't possibly be using Enlightenment categories to understand his world.
So he's not claiming those things are actually history, or that they represent...
Oh, no, he does think they're history, but he doesn't have our sense of what history is.
He does go on to say, Dr. Ehrman, that if this event did not occur, then our hope is in vain. He's starting to, and we are all still in our sins, he's kind of speaking there in the terms of transcendent truth. He does believe that there is some meaning attached to that resurrection.
If your definition of transcendent truth is that meaning is attached to an event, then okay, that's right. That isn't Paul's understanding of what meaning is, and he certainly doesn't have an idea of transcendent truth. God isn't transcendent for Paul. God is immanent in everything. God is present here with us. He's not transcendent from us. And truth does not exist as some kind of objective reality that has some kind of platonic form. These are categories that Paul simply doesn't have. I think the problem you're having is that you're having trouble separating your own assumptions about how truth and reality and objectivity occur, and you're assuming that everybody has these same categories. So what the problem is, you don't understand that you yourself have been raised in a post-Enlightenment world, and that your very categories have been affected by the environment in which you've been raised.
How would you respond, Dr. Ehrman, to someone who says, look, what you're really engaging in here is kind of selective citation? You've started with the presupposition that these events that are recorded in the New Testament narratives aren't true, and that memories can be distorted, and you've kind of selected the citations that seem to support that.
I'd say it's absolutely false. I don't start off with the assumption that everything's not true. Why would somebody think that's what I start with?
How would you respond to someone who says this is, you know, this method is just kind of too convenient?
Would you answer my question? Why would somebody assume that I start off assuming that things are not true?
How do you decide what is rightly remembered?
I told you just now, if you have two people who contradict themselves about an event, that at the point at which they contradict themselves, they both cannot be right.
Which one is?
Well, that's what you have to decide on the basis of an analysis. My point, you're asking me, how do you know something didn't happen? I'm telling you, if John says Jesus died the morning before the Passover meal was eaten, and Mark says Jesus died the morning after the Passover meal was eaten, they both cannot be right. So I'm not simply saying, well, I don't feel like this ought to be right, or, you know, I don't want it to be right. I'm saying that if you have a contradiction like that, they both can't be right.
So how does this change, for lack of a better term, Christian teaching, Christian doctrine, Dr.
I think what it does is it shows that fundamentalism simply can't be true, that the kind of literalist understanding of the Bible as having no mistakes of any kind is simply false. the Bible does have mistakes, and it's not because I want it to have mistakes. I started off thinking that the Bible had no mistakes of any kind, and that was my assumption going into it. What I try to encourage people to do is to look for themselves, not simply to accept what somebody tells them, that the Bible has no mistakes of any kind, but simply to see, does it have mistakes or not? And if you are open to the truth, you'll find the truth.
How would you respond to someone says what you've really done is kind of traded one fundamentalism for another, that is a fundamentalism that believes that there are no discrepancies or mistakes, for one that says if there are any, then it can't be true. There's no other explanation than that what we're reading here in one case is true and in the other case isn't true.
That's not my view.
What is it?
I never say that the Bible cannot, that no part of the Bible can be true.
No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that
if there's a contradiction, then both elements of the contradiction cannot both be true. That's not a fundamentalism. That's simple logic.
Isn't there a third way, and that is there may be apparent contradictions that have another explanation than simply saying one man claims this, the other one claims that?
Yes, that's a possibility too, and so you have to examine whether there's a way of reconciling the contradiction or not. If there's no way of reconciling the contradiction, then there is a third way. That's a very important way that I think your listeners need to think carefully about, because I think it's critical, which is that the truth may not reside in the historical facts. There might be some truth that is not based on history. When John, for example, says that Jesus died on the afternoon before the Passover meal was eaten, he's trying to make a point about that. In John's gospel, Jesus dies on the same day and at the same hour that the Passover lambs were being sacrificed in the temple. For John, the reason of that is that Jesus himself is the Passover lamb. Jesus, for John's gospel, and only in John's gospel, is the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world. And in order to illustrate his point that Jesus really is the Passover lamb, John changes the time when Jesus is killed so that he's killed when the Passover lambs are being killed. In other words, he's trying to make a theological point by changing a historical datum. And this is the kind of thing that happens regularly in the New Testament, where authors are not concerned about the historical facts so much as they're concerned about the theological truths.
Finally, then, Dr. Ehrman, for me here today, I actually believe that the New Testament accounts are accurate. I think there are explanations for the apparent contradictions that are there. But to use your term, what good does a remembered Jesus, rather than a historical Jesus who actually did those things, what good does a remembered Jesus do a sinner like me?
I think people ought to believe the truth rather than believing what they need to be true. And so if you're not open to changing your mind, if you're not open to evidence, if you're not open to seeing another side, then you're simply convincing yourself that you're true because you're right because you need to be right. And for me, that's unsatisfying intellectually.
But what good does a remembered Jesus as opposed to a historical Jesus do for
me? The remembered Jesus transformed the world we live in. The remembered Jesus is the most important figure in the history of civilization. So hugely important.
But what does he do for me? How does he deal with my sin? How does he deal with my dilemma?
I'm not a theologian. I mean, what you personally believe is really up to you. I'm talking about history. I'm not talking about personal belief. If you've got a personal belief, then of course your personal belief should coincide with facts. It shouldn't be simply coincide with fantasy. And so, but if you're unwilling to look at historical facts, that means that you don't have a belief that's informed by reality. You're trying to ignore reality in order to keep your faith intact. And I think that's really isn't the way people ought to live. I think people ought to look at facts and try to understand how their faith fits in with the facts rather than trying to shape the facts according to what they believe.
Dr. Bart Ehrman is Distinguished Professor of Religious Studies at University of North Carolina and author of several books, including his latest, Jesus Before the Gospels. Dr. Ehrman, you've been very generous. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks for having me.